Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hey everybody, this is Simon Majumda, and you are listening to Fascination Street Podcast. Enjoy.
I believe that everybody has a story, and I'm fascinated to hear them. So come with me as we take a walk down Fascination Street.
Welcome back, Streetwalkers. This episode is with Simon Majumdar. Simon is a world-traveling food critic. He is a Food Network personality. He is on tons of the Food Network TV shows, and he has been for well over a decade. In this episode, we talk about all things Simon. We talk about where he grew up and what got him interested so much in food. He tells a little bit of a story where there was a dark time in his life where he was considering ending his life, and it's going to sound crazy, but the lovely aroma of food saved his life. He tells that story. It's a really great story. And he tells some great stories about the history of food, which he talks about on his podcast, Eat My Globe. Much like me, he is fascinated to hear stories and to share them. But his is a little more particular to food and food history and food stories, and it's all wonderful. So check out his podcast. It's called Eat My Globe. They're about to start their 9th season. Everything from interviews with famous chefs and food writers and food historians to just giving you history lessons on food. It's a great show. I promise you, if you are fascinated to hear stories, and you must be because you're listening to this, then you will also be fascinated by his podcast, Eat My Globe. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you my conversation with the intellectually curious Simon Majumdar.
Yeah, talk to me, yeah.
Welcome to Fascination Street Podcast, Simon Majumdar. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, this is my pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, this is that Simon Majumdar. You know him from TV and from blogs, and you probably have seen him in an airport because this dude travels nonstop. So, Simon, what I like to do is start from the beginning, man. Where were you born and raised? How did you grow up?
Well, I was born in England, in the lovely historic city of Winchester, which is kind of southwest of London, kind of heading southwest-ish towards Cornwall Way for people who know Britain. So I was born there when my father was a surgeon there at the time. Then we actually moved up to, and I was raised in a kind of mine and steel town in the north of England called Rotherham. It used to be one of those kind of grubby old mine and steel towns. They always used to say the sparrows used to fly backwards to keep the muck out of their eyes. It was one of those old towns where everything was mine and steels, and everyone I knew, their parents worked in one of those industries, whether in administration or down the mines or in the steelworks. So we moved up there when I was very young, and that was where I was really raised. So in many ways, I consider myself a northerner, which in England is kind of like the blue collar working class area. I really liked it as a place. And then I moved down to London when I was 18 to study at university, to King's College London, part of the University of London, where I, oddly, for people who don't know me, I studied theology.
You were going to be an Anglican priest, right?
So, yeah, my kind of dream at the time. and still kind of one of those things that potters around my head a bit, was that I was going to be an Anglican priest. So I studied theology, have a degree in theology. But I think the church and I agreed pretty quickly that me as a priest was not going to be good for anybody.
Why do you think that was? What was it about the priesthood that turned you away?
I just think it wasn't a good match. And I think my kind of ways of connecting with people were, you know, much as I would like to have been in a little medieval village like Midsummer Murders or something, praising Christ in the day and solving mysteries in the evening, that was never going to happen. And I think it kind of came clear to me very early on. But I actually really enjoyed the degree because, oddly enough, it was quite a wide-ranging degree. You learn languages, I learned classics, learning to read kind of ancient Hebrew, and all kinds of interesting stuff that I did at the age of 18, 19, whatever university time. So I enjoyed that. But when you leave university, having trained with something so vocational, it was a little hard to get a job. So I ended up working in a bookshop, and that kind of began my first major career, which was in publishing, which I did for 20 years. And I published cookbooks, and I ended up being a kind of sales director for different companies, and then ended up helping to run a company. And that's really, apart from my family interest in food, which was obsessive, I'm sure we can talk about that, but that's where my kind of professional connection with food began, because we published lots of cookbooks, and, you know, cooking was always my passion. And so I was always called upon to help look at the cookbooks, and, you know, met a lot of the chefs in London at the time, some very special chefs. And that was really how I got into food. And that's when I started writing the blog, which is long gone now, but it was one of the very first food blogs in the world, I think. So that's a long time ago, way back when, in the midst of time, but there weren't many. Now I think there's probably a million of them out there. And so that's really how I came to the point that I was before I moved to the United States.
That blog, was that the one with you and your brother?
Yeah, Dos Hermanos. It, you know, it was really fun because we were older than a lot. I mean, bloggers in those days, it's a bit like, you know, TikTok people now. They tend to be younger on the whole. I mean, obviously not. You know, I've got a friend who's in his 60s who's got nearly a million followers on TikTok, an amazing weight loss surgeon called Dr. Terry Simpson. If people are on TikTok, they should go and follow him because he's brilliant. But blogging in those days tended to be a lot of young people, and they were writing about food, but A, they didn't have a lot of experience because, you know, at 23, I couldn't afford to go out to a lot of the fine dining places. So they weren't eating across the board. And so my brother and I just said, well, why don't we write about it? Because we go everywhere from a street stall in Spain to the finest of fine dining in Paris, because that's what we do. And so we started to write it. And oddly enough, it just became, I mean, hopefully it was because we write well, but I think people liked it because we were very honest. We never, as I do now, never take a free meal. If I go to a restaurant now, often people are kind and send out food, but we always then try and replicate that in our tip to the server. So, you know, we leave huge tips if someone is kind enough to. Or often chefs are very kind and they know me from the shows and they don't want to send out a check. And so I always get them to send out a check with one penny on it. Then I can leave the equivalent of the meal as a service tip for our fantastic servers who deserve all the help they can get right now. So we were like that. We never took a free meal. We never went to free events. We just went for meals and then we wrote about it. We were often quite brutal. So in the kind of early part of the 2000s, when we started writing, we were getting noticed alongside the professional critics in the newspapers and being quoted by the restaurants and by the papers along with them. So we just built up this kind of, and we were actually called by Vogue at one point. I still remember this. I think it was Vogue. It may be Esquire, as Michelin star bloggers, because we were kind of writing across the board and we traveled. And so it was great fun. But then obviously when I moved to the US and my brother was in the UK, it kind of, I think it was about a decade ago, in fact, that we stopped doing that. I mean, we haven't stopped being the same. So if you look at my WhatsApp or whatever it is that we use, our family, every single day there's pictures of food or that we've either been cooking or we've eaten out or with kind of fairly acute references to whether it's rather good or not.
Nice. Is your brother kind of doing that same thing now? Is he in any way doing what you're doing?
Not at all. He's in the IT business. He really did it as a form of fun. You know, he's done very well for himself. He's a very nice, generous guy. And so right now he's kind of between contracts and he's going off. I got emails from him the other day. He just decided to go to Paris for 3 days and eat at, you know, some phenomenal restaurants and get the train home. Yeah, we could do that if you're living in London. You get up one morning, go, I'd rather be in Paris, and you go to St. Pancras Station or King's Cross Station, whichever it is where it goes. You get on a train and 3 hours later or 2.5 hours later, you're in Paris sitting down having a glass of champagne and some lunch. So he's very fortunate, but he goes all over. He's been in Munich, in Amsterdam, and he just goes and travels. But so for him, it's a hobby, as it was when we were writing the blog. I'm the one who kind of turned it into, for want of a better word, a business.
What about growing up together made you guys really get this travel bug? Because you travel all the time, nonstop, and apparently so does he. So what was it about your upbringing that made you guys want to get the hell out of there?
Well, I think partly with the greatest respect to the lovely town of Rotherham, you know, it's a smallish town in the north of England. So in terms of that, it didn't have a lot to offer. And we would hear stories from my father, who's no longer with us. He died about 3 years ago. He was Bengali, born in Calcutta, had traveled, led an adventurous life, came over as a very young man to England as a doctor or as a ship's doctor on an Iranian freighter, you know, became, I think at a time, was the youngest person to ever qualify as a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons. You know, in England, he was an orthopedic surgeon, you know, married my mother, who was Welsh. So they had a mixed marriage in the 50s, which you can imagine. This is the point where houses could legally put up signs when they were renting saying, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish, on their window pane or whatever. So going in and trying to find a house for them was always very difficult. It was hard for him to get jobs in the kind of good areas as a doctor because he wasn't, you know, of the club. And we've seen a lot of that with the Boris Johnson and all the kind of posh Eton club that a lot of the doctors used to be of that time. And my mother as well, my Welsh mother, who at the age of 19 as a nurse when they met, hopped off and went to India and lived in India for, you know, a long time and lived in an Indian household without any fear and loved it. So they always put into us kind of a sense of adventure. So I would always want to be traveling. And I did a little bit, a lot of it as a publisher, but it was business related. So I'd often take a few days here and a few days there. What I didn't do, what a lot of young people do now, is this kind of gap year thing where they go off and they do a year before they go to college, which is great. They go to Thailand or they go around, particularly Southeast Asia, because it's more affordable. But it was only when I got to kind of my 40s, I'd saved a lot. I'd done very well in publishing. I'd saved. And I just said, yeah, I want to go out and travel. And then it went from being not only something that I wanted to do, that's something I actually needed to do, quite frankly, to still be on the planet, because I did go through some very dark times. You know, I became suicidal, quite frankly, and at one point was standing on the balcony of my apartment in London, getting ready to jump off four floors, you know, stories up, and luckily was saved by the people in the apartment below who were Lebanese. So I never got to meet. I think the father worked for a Lebanese bank, and they started opening the windows because they were cooking food and the wonderful smell of Lebanese food. If you're a fan of Lebanese food, you know just how gorgeous it is. And so I said, well, I'm more hungry than suicidal. So I went to cook a meal, and that kind of saved my life. And that was the beginning of this second stage of my journey that brought me to the United States.
Remember at the beginning, I said, if you don't want to talk about something, we won't. So feel free to insert that here. Do you want to talk about what was going on with you then that made things so dark and made you want to really end it all? I mean, you were what, in your 40s?
I was in my early 40s, and I absolutely don't mind talking about it because, you know, often people might see me and I'm sitting on the stage at guys' grocery games, or I'm running around doing Tournament of Champions, all of which are incredible things that I've been so blessed to be asked to do. And, you know, I'm very, very fortunate. But hopefully it shows people that even if you see someone who is doing something that a lot of people would love to do, you know, that may have started, or certainly their journey towards it started, in a very dark place. My mother had died of leukemia.
We have that in common. My apologies.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. As you know, obviously, very personally, that this is something that you don't lose that. I mean, people like to say that it gets a little easier. And of course, you're not sitting there on your couch every day, unable to move, as I was, you know, when she first died. But you never forget, you know, your mother, you know, unless people have a dysfunctional relationship, their relationship with their mother is a very important one. It was for me. She was an incredibly strong character, quirky, eccentric, Welsh. Had a fiery temper, but the most loyal, like literally the mother who would take a bullet to protect her family. And so when she left, you feel like that comforter that's over you, that protection is gone. So that was a big thing. And particularly as I wasn't there, I was in America on business, in fact, on the time, publishing business. And at the same time, the publishing company I was working for was struggling, and a lot of it were mistakes that I made helping to run the company. And that's also interesting when you're in your 40s, because you like to think that at that point, you're almost immortal and you're in your kind of pomp and you're running companies and, you know, you've got lots of people kind of coming to you. And then you realize that actually you're a bit thick and you're not very good at some stuff. And, you know, I realized that pretty quickly. So the company was struggling. And then I just had, you know, personal problems as well. And so as people know, when they do this, sometimes these things just get on top of you. And on a certain day, it just seemed better to me that I was better not here than being here. It would be easier for me. It'd be easier for everyone else. Luckily, thanks to our Lebanese friends and the joys of Lebanese cooking, I am here. But what happened was I went then, and I tell this story a lot at speaking events. I went to cook. And I was cooking a dish that's actually on my website, if anyone wants to cook it. Now, in our family, we call it LSD. And I hasten to add, it's not LSD that anyone might know if, like me, they're a fan of psychedelia bands of the 1960s. But it was life-saving dal. Dal is a kind of a rich protein lentil, almost soup or side dish from India. You can make lots of different lentils. I made mine with red lentils. And I was making this dish just above where I was cooking, where all my recipe books, but I also had a notebook there. And someone had sent me one of those Tony Robbins courses, which I didn't get a lot out of it. And I mean this in the nicest way, because I'm now an American citizen, but it's very American. I always joke when I tell this story on stage that it's lots of people whooping a lot. And you've heard me now. I don't do a lot of whooping. I always say I'm a whoop-free zone. But on this course, what they did have as part of it was like how to set goals, which is now something I do every day, daily and lifetime and, you know, kind of midterm and just things I want to do, things I need to do to kind of create who I want to be. Anyway, all of this list was really interesting. And I'd done them all. I'd had a suit made. Everyone, I think, should, if they can and can afford it, should always get something made for them, handmade, because there is something very special about having that done, particularly if you have a suit, which I had done. And I've lost enough weight now that I've got it in my closet here and I can still wear it, which is fantastic. Yeah, I ran a marathon. I had my teeth straightened. I always joke that I had very British teeth, that they were like an abandoned cemetery.
Was it a requirement to be an American citizen that you have your British teeth fixed?
Well, I don't know about that being a requirement, but one of the other requirements I know there must be somewhere that I've definitely failed is I hate pizza.
This interview is over.
Well, this is what most people say to me. I got into trouble in my first book as I described pizza as snot on toast. I got death threats and all kinds of people like sending me emails going, you should never be allowed in America. I go, no, I freedom of speech. I just don't like it. So there you go. Anyway, so that's another reason why I shouldn't be an American. Anyway, at the bottom of this list of kind of things to do or goals were the four words that now, you know, whenever I sign a picture or any book, I sign this. I just said, go everywhere, eat everything. I don't even remember at the time what I was thinking when I wrote it down, but I actually said, well, that's a good idea. And I'd saved up quite a bit of money. And so the next day I went to speak to the lady who owned the company that I was helping run with her.
The publishing company?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, she was very supportive. And she goes, look, if you're that unhappy, it's not good for you to be here. Why don't you go off? And she was like, well, if you want to come back in 6 months' time, after you've done travel, we'll figure something out. And you know, we love you. And all of the nice things that people say. And a few weeks later, I was on Bondi Beach in Australia. And what I'd done is I actually sat down and treated this as I would a business project. And I wasn't planning to write a book at this point. I wasn't planning to make it a business. I always said that if I had to come back, I'd get a job in a bar and I'd be the one on a street corner holding a sign saying, we'll drop trout for foie gras or something, you know, do whatever I needed to do. I ended up going on. And luckily, I wrote to a number of people who were in the food business and said, where should I go? And one of the most kind responses was from Tony Bourdain, who I didn't know well, but I knew him through a lot of the old public food forums like Chowhound and eGullet that used to be around back in the day. Chowhound, I think, closed fairly recently, back in April. I think it just closed for good, which was a shame. Anyway, I wrote to him and said, where should I go? And he goes, oh, you should write a book. And he sent me a quote to put on my book proposal, which is actually still on my book now. He said, you know, if you put this on your book proposal, people will open it because my name's on it. And he just published Kitchen Confidential there. So he wasn't as big as he became, but he was still incredible. Yeah, that book was a phenomenon even then. And he didn't need to do this. He just did it because he was a good guy. And so I ended up putting on the book proposal, but in a very Bourdain way, he said to me, your proposal better be effing good. Otherwise, I'm going to make me look bad and then I'll come and find you. It kind of very Bourdain-esque response. But he was very kind and then allowed me to put it on the book itself, Eat My Glow, my first book. And so I got in touch with an agent. I deliberately didn't get in touch with a book agent who I knew because I wanted them to believe it was a book that had purpose. They weren't looking at it because of, yeah, they knew me. And that was it. And I wonder about 3 or 4 months later, I was halfway up the Yangtze River in China, went into one of these internet cafes. I hate to say this, but you look like a guy of the age who remembers internet cafes. I talked to a lot of you.
That is offensive, but yes, I am.
A lot of the young people, when I talk to them on podcasts and other things, they're like, oh, I don't know what that is. I was like, really? But anyway, I went into this one halfway up the Yangtze River that they literally had to dust off the computer and plug it in. And do you remember the old dial-up noises and all of that?
Sure.
And I got a couple of emails from my agent going that they'd sold the book in America and they'd sold it in Britain. Enough money for me to go, well, I'm now an author. So that was the beginning of this second stage of the journey.
Hey, Streetwalkers. Here's a word from our sponsors.
So I ran into previous guest of this show, Chris Gronkowski, the other day, and it went a little something like this.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Hey, you know what sucks? When I get done with my workout at the gym, my protein shake's not cold anymore, man. It's room temperature.
Weird. I haven't run into you at the gym lately.
Busted. Okay, truth be told, I don't work out. But I do get thirsty after a long day of podcasting. I just can't seem to keep my cocktails cold.
You should use an ice shaker.
What's an ice shaker?
The ice shaker is a double-walled, vacuum-insulated, stainless steel shaker bottle with a patented twist and agitator that breaks up the protein powders.
So you're saying I should switch to an ice shaker, take out the agitator so I can fit more ice in the cup and it'll stay cold longer?
Steve, you don't need more ice. The ice shaker is third-party tested and verified to keep your drink cold for 30-plus hours.
Chris, you're a genius. I'll still remove the patented screw and agitator and just add more booze.
I guess technically you could, but if you actually use the ice shaker as a protein drink cup, the agitator breaks up the powder and doesn't bounce around like you're shaking a paint can.
Why are we still talking? Let's party.
Grog style!
That's right, Streetwalkers. Ice shaker is made from kitchen-grade stainless steel so it doesn't smell all funky after you use it a couple of times like those cheap plastic ones. When I'm out and about doing interviews or partying Gronk style, I use the Fascination Street Podcast Edition 26-ounce Flex Ice Shaker Cup, and it keeps my drink cold until the sun comes up. You saw Ice Shaker on Shark Tank. All 5 sharks made an offer with Mark Cuban and Alex Rodriguez closing the deal. Now you can get a deal too. Order your own 26-ounce Flex Cup right now at iceshaker.com and use the promo code FSP for $5 off your first order. Once again, that's iceshaker.com, promo code FSP, as in Fascination Street Pod, for $5 off your first order. That's iceshaker.com, promo code FSP.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah. Sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let's get back into it.
What were the words?
Well, from Bourdain?
Yeah. What did he tell you to put on the proposal?
It says, the dangerously obsessive, staggeringly knowledgeable, provocative and opinionated Simon Majumdar knows his shit. No question about it. I don't always agree with him, but he's always worth listening to. Many would kill to have eaten the meals in their lifetime that Majumdar has consumed in a single year. And he has an endearingly soft spot for the grimiest of low-life pubs. Plus, the bastard can write.
Wow.
And for him to do that for someone who he knew but didn't know well. I mean, we'd met a couple of times in, and I'm sure I'm not the only person to say that I went out in London and got very drunk in a pub till early in the morning, because I did, and then did the same at a fun place in New York called Sammy's Romanian, where the food is kind of okay, but you get huge bottles of vodka that come in blocks of ice. So we sat and drank vodka till quite early in the morning too, talking about his favorite places for sushi. And yeah, he was complete food obsessive. And one of the things, not that anyone could ever be like Bourdain, and I'm certainly not either in terms of quality or in terms of just complete obsession with links to culture, but he was just this extraordinary kind of link to how food and culture meet. And I think everyone who writes about food should at least kind of look to what he did, because, you know, we'll never see his like again. Anyway, so I wrote the book and it did okay. I mean, it certainly didn't change my life in terms of sales, but it was, you know, did okay. You know, that brought me over to the United States. I was doing a book tour here around the US. I met my wife on my journey around the world. We were in Brazil. She was in Brazil on her own on vacation, and we met in Salvador da Bahia. And so I came over here to meet her when I was on my book tour, and, you know, I ended up proposing, and so we've been married 12 years now. So that was my movement over to the United States. I thought I'd write here and I'd, you know, carry on some of my articles that I'd started to write after the book, but I had no idea the kind of next stage of the journey would happen. I met a manager who'd read my book and had listened to me on some show on the BBC World Service and got in touch, who was also in LA, where I'm based now. And at the same time, I think someone at the Food Network had read my book at an airport. If they'd been delayed or something, they'd bought the book. And the next thing I know, I'm getting an email from my manager going, they want you to be on this show called The Next Iron Chef. It was a show where they choose the next Iron Chef. What's funny now, when I look back, and I've been on 13, 14 years or whatever it is, I've been on the Food Network now. Yeah, we have our own cooking shows in the UK. We have our own big shows. You know, I often have to remind people, we make our own TV too, you know, Britain. But I didn't know what Iron Chef was. So I had to go, like, get on my computer at the time, my old Apple that weighed a half a ton, and watch some YouTube things of Iron Chef, find out what it was. And then I did some screen tests. And the next thing I know, I'm on a beach with Alton Brown and Michael Simon and going, oh, okay, I guess I'm doing this now. And I assumed, it, you know, they'd have me on for one season and, you know, that would be it. And that was fun. But they keep on asking me back.
Which season of The Next Iron Chef was it? Who ended up winning?
It was season 3. And I think Mark Forgione won. And then I did season 4 and 5. And then they stopped doing Next Iron Chef. But that was Jeffrey Zakarian and Alex Guarnicelli.
Nice.
Yeah, they're all friends now. But they were amazing chefs. And I mean, particularly the one that Jeffrey won. I mean, that was everybody. They got everybody. You had Anne Burrell, you had Robert Irvine, you had everybody. To be honest, it's like you're judging them and you're judging them properly, but yeah, they're a pretty intimidating group. Marcus Samuelson was on it. Elizabeth Faulkner was on. I mean, this was I don't think you would be able to get a group that good again on a show. I just don't think you would. I mean, they're all so well known now.
It's a murderer's row.
Yeah.
My wife and I never missed an episode. Not only did we watch all of Iron Chef America, but we watched every single episode of The Next Iron Chef. And up until a couple of years ago when we cut the cord and got rid of cable, if you turned on our TV at any point during the week, it was on Food Network. We're huge Food Network people. It's one of the reasons I reached out to you. I guess I'm collecting Food Network chefs and personalities and, you know, Food Network regulars. So besides you now, I've had Jason Lord Honeysmith on twice, Damaris Phillips, Catherine McCord. I've had Sarah Penrod, Stephen McHugh, and now you. I mean, I'm going to get the whole set. So they called you initially to, I guess, be a judge on The Next Iron Chef?
Yeah, so it was one of these 10 episode arcs, mm-hmm. where, you know, one is let go every episode. My place at the table, as it were, was right next to Alton. So TV being a lot of hurry up and wait, we'd often just be sitting at the desk while they were moving cameras, doing all kinds of other stuff. So I ended up chatting a lot with Alton Brown. Turned out we have, you know, a lot in common. Obviously, he's the science guy when it comes to everything but the food. He is genuinely, I would say, genuinely the smartest person I've ever met. But what I like about him particularly, it was what I like about people particularly, the ones who are constantly inquisitive, what I call intellectually curious. They don't think they know everything because they know they don't. You know, and it's what people used to say about Einstein, that he was constantly asking questions about everything from, you know, how to make a cup of coffee to how to do this, because he was constantly trying to fill in gaps in his knowledge. And kind of one of the things I really like about him is he'll go, well, what is that? Or I'll use a word. I use, you know, some British words, and he'll go, well, where does that come from? Tell me about that. And you go, okay. And interestingly, the other person who I work with a lot now who has got that same intellectual curiosities guy, I'll say something during Tournament of Champions in a small break or even during the filming, he'll go, what do you mean? What is that? Something that I'll throw out there. Like I talked about broccolini on one of them. I said, oh, someone's cooking with broccolini. And I said, oh, out of interest, it was created in Japan in 1976 because they didn't like thick-stemmed broccoli. So they, yeah, the Japanese being the Japanese, took something good and made it even better. And he's like, really? And then he'll just want to start to talk about that because he has that same. But so with Alton on Next Iron Chef, we've become very good pals and swap emails and texts and often about history and science. It's not like, how are you? Well, I mean, he'll always ask how I am, but it's like, have you heard about this? And I'll go, oh, no, I don't. Let me go look it up. So we both share it. But then I was also with Donatella and Michael Simon, who's, again, just one of the good guys. So that was really interesting because I'd done a little bit of TV in the UK, but not very much, on some food shows where I'd been asked to come in, comment on something, but not to this level, and certainly not as a show that was, at that point, the biggest show on the network when it was airing. It was the show that everyone wanted. And I suddenly realized from when the first show aired that this was a big deal. And I kind of put it away, and obviously no one knew me between when we filmed and when it was aired. So I'm running around, and I couldn't tell anyone that I'd been on, you know, because you have to keep quiet about these things. Once it started airing, of course, you get good, bad comments. I can't remember, there was a website that was called, I can't remember, it was like just saying mean things to people on television. I can't remember what it was called back then, but it's gone now. But it was, there's lots of people coming in going, you know, this bald English guy, and they decided whether they liked me or hated me. I guess enough people liked me that they invited me back. So now, you know, I've done that show, Cutthroat Kitchen, Beat Bobby Flay, Guy's Grocery Games, you know, Alex's new shows. And I love doing it. I love the people. I love the crew. The crews who work on these shows, probably as much as I love the chefs, because they're just the hardest working people I've ever met in my life. And, you know, there's me going, oh, I have to get in at 8 o'clock into the thing. And they've all been there since 5 o'clock in the morning setting up. So I'm very appreciative of the crews. It's become a part of my life. And it's also a part that has allowed me to go on and do other things. So I get invited to travel now or to go to see certain things if I go to certain countries because of what I do, because it's popular all over the world. I've been getting lots of emails from, you know, India and Cutthroat Kitchen and Tournament of Champions or whatever. They're really popular in India. And you're going, well, that's good because I have an Indian heritage. So maybe at some point we'll go back there. And I just think it's given me opportunities doing my own podcast. I do a food history podcast, which I call Eat My Globe, in kind of honor to the first book. I'm just writing season 9 right now. After I chat with you, I'm going to finish off my episode on the history of corn. And so I get to do that. And because of the fact that the show does well, I've got to interview some incredible people like Ken Burns and Jacques Pepin and Alton Brown, all about food history. You know, so to me, that's a hobby in the nicest sense of the word, but I take it very, very seriously, and like you do yours. And so I kind of come to this really nice point in life where I get to do some really fun things. I get invited to do some fun things. People on the whole, you know, there's always people who don't like you, but on the whole, people are very kind to me when I'm out and about. But I'm not so crazy famous that anyone wants to disturb me. They recognize me from somewhere, but they're not quite sure.
You're that guy from that thing.
Yeah, that's exactly. I remember that. There's an amazing documentary, that guy from that film or something. And there's one with women as well. And it's all these really well known, you recognize them the moment you see them, but you have no idea quite why. And I kind of like being in that position because I've seen, you know, walking with some of the very famous people that I've had the fortune to work with. They can't walk down a street.
Alton and Bobby can't walk down the street.
Oh, no, they can't. And yes, that brings benefits to it, obviously, you know, financial and popularity and all of that. But trust me, no one's ever stopped me walking down a street unless they think I'm going to frighten their kids.
Just real quick, everybody listening, Simon mentioned his podcast. It's called Eat My Globe. They recently finished season 8. He does it in seasons. He's been doing it for a couple of years. And this podcast covers everything from the history and the importance of spam all the way to the invention of the microwave. And it's very engaging. And he's not kidding when he basically said he's a nerd for history and the history of food, because he nerds out like crazy on some of this stuff. And it's really, really fascinating. I see what I did there. I do have a couple of questions for you. What washes up on really small beaches?
That's one of my, I like to start every episode so people think I do take it seriously, but they know I'm not being too serious about it. So I like to start off with little bad dad jokes. And so that one was, what washes up on really small beaches? Microwaves.
I love it. After I heard that one, I paused and I just took a deep breath and I said to my wife, I love that this dude's into dad jokes.
I love them. I'm not going to share it yet, but I've got a great one for the history of corn, but I love it as well. So we have an amazing producer, Eat My Globe. Well, actually, we're going for 4 years now, believe it or not.
Wow.
I had no idea. We've done, you know, kind of 80 episodes. And a lot of that is some of interviews. I try and split it 50-50 between the interviews, mm-hmm. because if there are people who've got really great books out on food history, I'd love to get people to know those so they understand. Because what I'm trying to do with Eat My Globe in my own kind of small way, we'll talk about food, obviously, from a gourmet point of view or a culinary point of view in terms of cooking. But what we don't realize is how important food has been to our history, not just in the United States, but to the world. To give you a kind of advanced thing on corn, the Portuguese were the people who brought corn into Africa. They brought it originally to feed their soldiers in the forts, but then African farmers started doing it. It was incredibly nutritious. African farmers started eating it. It actually, they've done this research now that it created an increased population density and through that an increased amount of slavery. So the notion of bringing corn into Africa to feed your troops had a run-on in the 16th and 17th century into the amount of slaves that were sent out of Senegal, you know, the horrors of slavery, the people that came over. And, you know, rice, the same. You know, rice was brought over, what was called African rice was brought over by slaves. And so here's something that we take so much for granted in the United States. And you're going, but it has this really dark history as well, because not only was it obviously the dark history of the relationship of colonists in the United States with Native Americans who grew it, but also its relationship with slavery. So you're just going, and this is corn that, you know, you'd see a bag of corn, popping corn or whatever in your, or sweet corn. And you go, oh, that's nice for a picnic. And you go, yeah, but just be aware that this has thousands of years history. And what I want to do is, people don't need to remember all of that necessarily. Well, they should definitely remember its impact on slavery, because we all should. But what it definitely should do is go that everything we eat, everything we put in our mouth, whether it's beef, which is an indigenous to America or whatever, has a story. And people have lived and died because of it. And what I want is for people just to go, oh, I didn't know that. And if even if it just makes them think of it, and I always say in the episodes, here's a story that you can bore people with at a dinner party, like a fun story, like the fact that Wall Street was built because it was a wall there, and it was built to keep feral pigs from coming into the city and destroying the buildings. And that's why the wall was built. And I wrote about this in History of Pork, and you just go, actually, that's fantastic. That's a great story. So I love to fill it with these kind of stories that will make people think about what they're eating. Because I think too much, and particularly I think in the United States more than in Europe or Southeast Asia and South Asia, we just think about gluttony and we think about big portions. And you go on Instagram, and it's like, oh, it's a huge portion of this. And look at the size of this hamburger. And you go, it's all well and good. Well, there's not much good about it. But actually, let's just think about why these foods came here. Why certain things? You know, do we know that Abraham Lincoln said that coffee was one of the reasons the Union won the Civil War? because the Union soldiers had proper fresh coffee that would keep them awake, and they would have it early in the morning. And he said it would keep them alive and keep them on a hull, whereas the Confederate soldiers had hickory coffee, which did nothing for them. They go, oh, who knew that? And yet all of the coffee that came into the Union came in from Brazil, where it was all grown by slaves. And you go, that's a weird kind of bad coincidence, given what was going on. So these stories to me are, as you said, I nerd out about them. I think about them all the time. I'm not expecting everyone to be as big a nerd as me about them, although a lot of people are. But I just want to share them. And if I want to be anything, as you can tell by the amount that I'm talking today, you've hardly had a chance to say a word. I'm sorry. But I just want to tell stories about who we are as Americans.
We have that in common. So my show is Fascination Street, and it's because I believe that everybody has a story to tell, and I'm fascinated to hear them and to share them. And that's what you do with food and the history of food. And I think that's wonderfully quaint that that's what you've chosen to talk about. There's so many other things that people are talking about nowadays, and it's all rife with disappointment and hate. So I'm really glad that you have chosen a subject that is purely informational. In the episodes that I've listened to, which is quite a few, I mean, occasionally you'll give barely an opinion, but for the most part, you're just presenting information. And I think that's really a great way to go. And I love that you're focusing on the history of all these things. I have a few questions. One,
yeah,
you mentioned that you tell occasional little stories, sometimes humorous, sometimes not, whatever, about whatever your subject is. Can you tell everybody listening to the show right now why British people hold their pinky up when they drink tea?
Well, the anecdotal story is that when we have afternoon tea, and just let me start at the beginning, the afternoon tea should never be called high tea. So if you ever see high tea, that's always wrong. High tea was the poor man's meal that was eaten at the high table. That was like some bread and some jam before they went back out to do the hard labor. So if you see it being called high tea, it's incorrect. So it's afternoon tea. It was created by the Duchess of, it's spelt Belvoir, but it was pronounced Beaver. Then she started having in her country house in the late 1700s, having a sinking feeling where there was a long gap between breakfast and dinner, and there wasn't really a big lunch period there for the aristocracy. So they would bring her out cakes and little sandwiches and things. And she started doing this and inviting friends. And then when she went back down to London, people would copy her or come to her soirees, or not soirees because that'd be in the evening, but like her little salon, her tea events, afternoon tea with the Duchess. And then what happened, this became incredibly popular, and they started copying it when hotels first opened. The very first hotel in London, Brown's Hotel, which is still there, and I still think does one of the very best afternoon teas in London. So good. They actually have two tea sommeliers who come around and have like 20 types of tea, and they'll talk you through the types, like first flush Darjeeling or whatever. Anyway, but if you were in someone's house, of course, if you were being invited by the Duchess, she would know who you were. She would have sent a card to your house. You would have replied with a card saying you were delighted to come. Well, when you go to a hotel and you're in a grand ballroom, no one knows who you are. And you wanted people to know who you were because you were members of the upper class in England. And yeah, those of you who've watched Downton Abbey or before that, Upstairs, Downstairs, which was one of my favorite shows, which was, I think, kind of Downton Abbey without the budget, but I still loved it. So the theory and the story is that when you were drinking your tea at your lovely table, when you held your tea in this beautifully made ceramic cups, you would hold your pinky, or as we call it in England, a little finger. And you actually had a pinky ring on there, which had the coat of arms of your family, the crest of your family. You did this so as someone of import, like the Duchess, walked past you, she could see that you were someone who deserved to be, you know, there. And you're not some kind of wannabe coming up from the trades, because there was a big thing, particularly in the early part of the 19th century, where there was a lot of people becoming very wealthy, you know, the Industrial Revolution. There'd be people who owned steel mills or coal mines or, you know, mills for cloth. And they were becoming increasingly wealthy and very wealthy, much wealthier than the aristocrats. They were trying to kind of come into this society, but they were always dismissed as being tradesmen or shopkeepers, you know, whatever. And so they wanted to know that they weren't coming into these kind of events, because it would lower the tone if you had some very rich shopkeeper kind of interloping their way in. And actually, you know, the thing is, in England, we see it now, and not going into politics, but we saw it yesterday with Boris Johnson. They're talking about how every prime minister of Britain since whenever has gone to not Mrs. Thatcher didn't, but just about everyone has gone to these schools, and they don't want anyone working class coming in to be running the country because they think that's not quite proper, which is obviously ludicrous. But it's just this thing that I think this spine of Britain that we've had from the old days, and even something like afternoon tea exemplifies that, that people would drink with their little finger up. And it was nothing to do with balance and holding the cups.
Hey, Streetwalkers, here's a word from our sponsors.
Yeah, I'm not one of the dadgum historians, patsies, dreamers, and wannabe on Route 66. I'm the real deal.
That's Harley Russell, the most colorful citizen of Eric, Oklahoma. He's just one of many characters you'll meet this season in Vanishing Postcards as we motor west cross-country on Route 66.
There's so many stories on Route 66 that are going to disappear. And so one of the most valuable things I think about traveling Route 66 is to hear people's stories.
From an eating contest in the Texas Panhandle to a morning on the Santa Monica Pier, we'll experience much of 66 while exploring how its past, present, and future are revealed through the people and places you'll find driving it today. I'm Evan Stern, and invite you to ride along by following Vanishing Postcards wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get back into it.
Interestingly enough, sorry, again, I'm just now you've got me. I could just go on forever. I'm very much from the blue collar end of it. There's a reason in England why you put your milk in your tea, not coffee, because I'm allergic to coffee. I can't drink it.
Wait a minute. Hold on. That sounds like a lie that you say because you're British.
No. I get a reaction to it. And here's where I think it comes from. God bless my mother, who's obviously not with us, but we used to go to Spain a lot, and my mother would have her little heart starter in the morning at 10 o'clock or whatever in one of the local cafes in Spain, and they would pep up her coffee, a very strong Spanish coffee, with a little dose of some local liqueur. And that was like her little heart starter. Yeah. And when she was on holiday, why not? And one day, I'm told that I drank this coffee that, you know, probably had three shots of something in it, and they didn't measure pours in Spain. They still don't.
Sure.
My Spanish is bad, but as they pour a drink, they actually have a saying in Spain that you should be able to tell a good length story while you're pouring. You know, it's like that's their attitude towards alcohol. But anyway, I drank this and was, you know, pretty unwell because I was three or four. But it does actually have a reaction on me now. I have to be very careful. So, yeah, if I'm on shows and stuff, I always just have to be careful and go, by the way, you do know I don't eat coffee. They're very good. I have to say the culinary departments are superb. But anyway, so the story is that we have this thing in England that you either put your milk into the cup first and then pour the tea on top of it, or you pour the tea in and then you put milk in at the end. And the reason we have those two differences, and some people do that here, is that if you were rich, could afford it, you had the beautiful ceramic cups that didn't crack if you poured boiling hot tea into them. You'd add the tea and then you would add the milk. Whereas in the north, you would put the milk in first and then put the boiling tea because that would just reduce it a lot. So in your earthenware mugs, you wouldn't crack the mug. Now, again, to me, there's something that separates Britain off into two different cultures. And yet I still do it. My milk is always in my tea first because I come from a working town in the north of England. And I still do it. I don't need to do it, but it's just so habitual now.
See, guys, that's what I'm talking about. This is the kind of stuff that he talks about on his show. Again, his podcast is called Eat My Globe. Season 9 will be coming out, I don't know, fairly soon. I only have a couple more quick questions before I'm going to let you go. Julia Child's husband, Paul, said once, if every critic could silence every artist, how dull would the world be? I mean this with the utmost respect. And this is an honest question. What qualifies Simon Majumdar to be a food critic?
No, I think that's a fair question to ask. I think in my case, number one, it's experience. So I haven't just been eating in America or just in LA or just in Britain. Yeah, I've been eating all over the world. So if someone goes, I have made X, and I go, well, no, you haven't, because, you know, I've been struggling through the markets of Japan, or I've been walking in China, or I've been walking in India. And I go, no, I know what it is and what you've made really isn't. Now, I can tell you where it might be good. That doesn't mean that it's a bad dish, but calling it that. So I can call out a lot of the qualifications. The other side is that it's constant. So what's interesting is people go, oh, well, the chefs are much more interesting to judge. And I go, but actually, if I talk to a lot of the judges, they don't go out that often. You know, they're too busy behind the kitchens and they're concentrating on their own dishes. And I talk to them often about meals, and I won't name names, but when I'm on a table, you know, judging, them go, what is it again? Remind me. And they'll ask me, so for the names of it. And that's not because they're thick. They're very smart people and my very dearest friends, but they often go, I don't know this, because they're in their own kind of thing. They're cooking Italian food, cooking whatever. And I think the other side is, we talked about it earlier, the intellectual way of looking at food. So it's constant for me. You know, after I finish with you, I'm going to be writing about corn. When I finish with that, I'm going to be writing with someone about the history of Jewish Sabbat, also about, you know, some of the Jewish festivals. I've written about Christian ones. So I think there's things that I can put in. And I don't say they're better than, but they add a balance to. So say I'm on a judging panel with Antonia Lofaso, who has incredible views on food and very smart. She's incredibly smart. But there are things where she goes, well, I just don't know what this is. And then I'll come on and go, well, I can talk about that. And so we're not in challenge to each other. We're a team. So I think we have a part of the parcel. It's unfair, I think, of sometimes people who criticize because they're assuming, A, we don't cook. And I cook professionally and cook at dinners, you know, and I'm cooking hotels. So I do cook a lot. What I don't do, and why I never use the word chef for myself until sometimes on computers I do, because it's too hard to have an argument with someone about it if I've only got a few words to use. But I do cook. But I think we're a team. Yeah, you know, that's what I like to think about when we do these things. We're a team. So I think it's easy to criticize the critics, but I think, you know, depending on how good they are, they're an important part of the process, if that makes sense.
I love it. That's a perfect answer. I have heard that you always, always have on your person British tea bags. Do you have some right now?
I have just finished a large cup of tea and I keep mine in my freezer. But just to show you that I do, I'm bringing this just so you can see. Yes, I do.
Aha.
These are my favorites. I'm very rarely more than 5 feet away from this particular make, Taylor's Yorkshire Gold, which is my favorite. Let me get back into my seat properly. I'm too excited to be near my tea bags. I should sit there and stroke these like Blofeld with his cat. But Taylor's Yorkshire Gold, they own a very famous tea shop in Harrogate in England. And the same company, Taylor's, they make tea. So they bring this in from, if I remember rightly, when I went to meet them, I did an interview with them. They bring it in from Africa. They bring it in from India. And there's one other place they bring it in from. It might be a Chinese blend. But, you know, there's a great episode. I will just plug in my thing again on tea that I did on Eat My Globe. Again, one of the best stories. Tea was really just in China. And in fact, pain of death, if anyone tried to take it out of China, it was a sacred thing. It was I mean, if people go and listen to the episode, there was one British guy, the English were buying it from the Chinese and often paying an opium for it. It was in those days, back in the 1700s and 1800s. But the British wanted to create a bigger volume because it was becoming so popular in England. The Chinese wouldn't let them have any tea to grow themselves because they considered it, you know, too vital to their economy. So the British actually sent in this botanist, Robert Fortune. You wouldn't do this now, but he browned himself kind of up to look like we're talking about the late 1700s, early 1800s, to kind of colored his face so he looked like someone who'd been in the sun and made himself to look as someone from China, and went in and worked, got a job in one of these Chinese tea plantations and stole some of the tea plants. He put them in one of those bamboo canes that you often see people putting over their shoulders that they had baskets on, kind of declared himself to be a worker, and then walked huge amounts from wherever the plantations were in China, I'd have to remind myself, to India. First of all, to Assam, which is still very famous for tea, started planting these there. It was one of the first kind of industrial espionage that this British botanist who worked at Kew Gardens carried it all the way to Assam. At every point, particularly when he was in China, if they'd have caught him, they'd have killed him because this was such a precious thing. Now, looking back with a historical point of view, you're going, this is kind of not a good thing that happened, but it was part of the British Empire and wanting to rule the world. And you know, they almost did for a while. And you tell this story of Robert Fortune, but you make the most amazing film. I don't know who you'd have, some very British guy. Like, Hugh Grant would probably do it quite well because he was kind of in his 40s, 50s. Well, Hugh Grant is in his 50s. And the story, you'd probably have to quieten down some of the stories because I think he, did a few things on his route. But it's just to get tea. So for me to get this Taylor's Yorkshire Gold, I should be on money from these people. I write about them enough. But for him to get tea to India so it could be grown in the quantities, and Sri Lanka also, what was then Ceylon, it was grown in sufficient quantities that they could then sell it throughout Britain in the early equivalents of supermarkets and grocery stores at a price that it became the national obsession. So all down to this one man.
You have to subscribe to his podcast, Eat My Globe. When does the new season come out?
We're looking to start it in October. I have to record the interviews. And some of those are books that haven't quite come out yet. But I had a great one sent to me right now called Doctors and Distillers that I'm going to start at the weekend, which is all about the original use of alcohol in medicine, which is how it started. A lot of the shots we take of whiskey, whatever, they were medicinal. And that's still what I tell my doctor. People are very kind, but they do sometimes send me emails going, when's the next season? And I go, writing every season is the equivalent of writing a book and includes enormous amount of research before I even put my fingers to my little keyboard here. I'm looking to get everything finished, my episode, 6 episodes that I'm writing, by the end of August. And I've read all the books and sent questions to all of the people. Just because you're here and I'm feeling generally, we've got Andrew Zimmern going to do an interview, and I've always wanted Andrew to be on, and we've never been able to get the times right. And doing a show about food history and food travel without Andrew Zimmern just doesn't seem possible.
Agreed.
But we're also introducing people who are not so well known in terms of being famous, but writing really great books. There's a guy called Fred Hogg coming on who has just written a book called Of Ice and Men. It's about the history of ice and how it changed our life. I've talked about this on the show. You can edit all this out. But just another great guy in America called Frederick the Ice King Tudor. And this is an incredible story. He was a man from the Northeast, and he took out licenses that he could cut huge blocks of ice from Walden Pond and all those other Northeast lakes. And think how clear the water was then. We're talking in the early part of the 18th, middle part of the 18th century. He would cut them out, huge blocks. I mean, we're talking blocks the size of a truck. He would wrap them in hay, and he would ship them to Australia, India, the Seychelles, all over the world. And he would also give ice blocks away free in New Orleans to all the bartenders. And the reason he did that, because he wanted to create ice drinks, because he thought it would, as it did, because they used to serve warm punches. There was no way of icing drinks, or they would serve them room temperature. And he was, well, what about ice drinks? And of course, all the bartenders down there went, that's a good idea. And he gave them the ice free at first, like a pusher. And then they started making ice drinks. You can go to India, and I've been there. There's a very famous club in Calcutta, which is where my father was from, where you can actually sit in the club. It's called the Tollygung Club. And in there, they have a purchase book where they have a menu from the 1860s, maybe earlier, where you could have a gin and tonic, which they created in India to get the British soldiers to drink quinine. That's by the by. But yeah, that's why you have gin and tonic, because the original tonic had quinine in it and it stopped the officers getting malaria. And so they created gin and tonic because they wanted it with alcohol. That's where it was created in the 1860s or 1850s. But you could have it with ice from Walden Pond.
Whoa.
In Calcutta. We think we're all very kind of smart and up to date with everything now. Can you imagine?
No.
That in the 1860s, you could drink a gin and tonic with ice from Walden Pond. And you'd have to be rich enough as a British officer to be able to afford it, because it was shipped in. And he was very clever. He built ice houses in all of these places where the money was. And you could get ice from New England to ice your drinks in India. Now, if you're not excited about that, we're probably not going to do well if we sat next to each other at a dinner party. But I just think that's the greatest story. Just like the most amazing. Frederick the Ice King Tudor. And in fact, if you go and listen to my interview with Alton, where I challenged him to name 5 people who'd been forgotten by food history, he names Frederick as one. And one of the others he names is, whose name I've forgotten off the top of my head, the lady who created the brown paper bag that they used to have at grocery stores. As you can tell, even now, I've told that story a million times about the ice, but I still get excited about it. It makes me very happy to share that story, because I guarantee you'll tell that story to somebody at some point. Who knows when?
Well, you just told it to a bunch of people, but yeah, I'm going to tell that story. That's amazing.
Yeah. So that's kind of the reason I love doing this, because even now, like I said, I've told that story a gazillion times. That is still just the look on people's faces when I tell them that. And that there's proof, there's purchase records from these very exact purchasing ledgers in Calcutta that was all done with kind of British and Indian kind of attention to detail. I just love it.
That is amazing. I love your passion. I'm going to lie and say I have one more question. Was there anything that we didn't talk about or I didn't ask you about that you wanted to talk about today? Like, did I miss anything?
The only thing that I really love to talk about is, you know, we live in this very polarized world in the United States, in the world generally, but in the United States. And one of the things that I think about food is that I can use food, and I try and use food, to present a way of us coming together. I have this saying that you can't have an argument with me with a mouthful of ribs. I'm very honest about, you know, my politics. I'm a very liberal person. I come from a very kind of liberal background in the UK. And yet I can sit down with people from all parts of different parts of the United States, and I have done, and they're my friends because of food. And yeah, if we talked about the politics, we could have a row, but I go, let's not. For this hour or 2 hours, let's find out the things we have in common. And you can't argue with someone over a table and they go, can you pass the potatoes? So food to me is a real safe space. And it's something that I consider really, really valuable. And I meet with people who are very different politically from me. And I really want to use food as my way and other people's way, I'm sure, of bringing us together. It may not solve many things, but it at least solved dinner time.
I love that. I love that you said you can't have an argument with somebody at a dinner table and say, hey, can you pass the potatoes? There's a story in my wife's family where her younger brother, he was a little bit handicapped. And so he sort of had a little bit of a extra leeway, if you will. He had a longer leash, so to speak. Uh-huh. And he was unhappy with somebody at the table one day or something. And so he did say, can you pass the potatoes? But what he said was, can you pass the potatoes, asshole? They tell that story all the time. Okay, last question. Can you give me the recipe for Ted Lasso's biscuits?
Well, I won't give them from me because they should go to the person who put them on TikTok and whatever, because I copied them and I actually put a link to it because I think the person who did it, although to be fair, they're pretty much just a shortbread biscuit. So anyone who tells you that, you know, they're filled with unicorn juice or whatever is lying. Ted Lasso is one of my favorite things on TV. My wife is interested in football in any way, but I'm obsessed with proper football. I've yet to become obsessed with American sport. I am obsessed with football. Although no one here knows of my team because it's my local team, Rotherham United, who actually got promoted to the Championship just below the Premier League last season, which is amazing. And I'm incredibly happy. My dad used to be the club doctor there at one point, or the club surgeon. So he operated whenever, you know, they had accidents with their knees and saved their careers. But I still go, I always say it's a small crowd. When you call them, and you say, what time does the game begin? They go, what time can you show up? It's that kind of level of crowd. Actually, to be fair, they get about 8,000, but they're not a big club. It would be the equivalent of like a AAA baseball, I kind of think. Not that I know much about that. But and actually, when people ask me in the United States, they go, who are you going to support? Like as a soccer club here. And they go, oh, well, you're next to, you know, the LA whatevers and the Ram. And I just go, I have no interest. I support this team in Fresno that's about the same level, that gets about 6,000. They're the people whose goals I look out for. And it's because they make me feel at home. They're the people who go and watch those, right? You know, in very many ways, the same kind of people. You're talking about Fresno. It's a working class area. And I know that going to that game would be, in many ways, the same thing as going to watch Rotherham United. That's what I miss sometimes about being in England. I love, you know, I'm a dual citizen. I miss going to my local football game and just sitting there and with a meat pie or whatever, something great, and just watching a game in the pouring rain and just watching kind of your team often lose miserably. I've been to games where we lost 6-0 and you're kind of with all your friends and you kind of, as you leave, you all kind of nod to each other and say, see you next week. Or we'll even get in a car to drive because Britain's so small and we drive, you know, halfway across the country to watch our team lose and then we come back. So I do miss that side of it. So I have no idea why. Oh, we were talking about Ted Lasso. So I do put the link on TikTok for those who are on there. I did put a link, I think, on Instagram. So to be fair to the people who shared it, go and look at that. Although I loved making them. It's not my recipe by any means.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Simon Majumdar, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day and your hectic world traveling food tasting schedule to hang out and let us get to know you a little bit better on Fascination Street. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. I like talking, as you've noticed. So, and I love sharing stories. And I know you have from the people you've interviewed, you have a great crowd of people who want to listen. And, some of the stories are fun, but some, I think, are just a good way to bring us together, and some of the history. I just want to share it with as many people as possible. That's why I'm banned from most airlines, I think, because I start telling stories on airlines if anyone gives me the chance, just because I love them.
Well, that's actually why I started my show, is because I was on a couple of airplanes and I would listen to just regular people tell me stories about their life. And I'm just like, why didn't I record that?
Yeah.
Other people would like to hear that story. So that's why I started my show. Simon, thank you. If I had a hat, I would don it. I am so, like that. I am so honored that you took the time here today. And I just thank you so much, man.
It's genuinely my great pleasure. I love chatting about this. The more I can share, the better. And right now, when we're all finding ways to hate each other, just chatting about food. And, unless you're a real crazy person, you don't get angry with someone over food. We can all talk about that with civility. And civility is one of the many things that we're missing right now. And, we haven't even touched on why should we on politics for the last hour. And that's great, because it means I don't know. I don't care. I just know you love food, you love stories, and you're a good person. And that's it.
Those are great words to go out on, man. I appreciate your time. Tell Sybil I said thank you and I said hello.
I will.
And thank you so much, Simon. You have a great weekend, man.
My pleasure. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Opening music is the song Magnolia from the 2001 album Intransigence, used with permission from Douglas Miles Clark. Closing music is from the song Say My Name off the 2021 album Underdog Anthems, used with permission from Jax Hollow. If you like the show, tell a friend, subscribe, and rate and review the show on iTunes and wherever else you download podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. All the episodes are available there as well. Check me out on Vero at Fascination Street Pod and TikTok at Fascination Street Pod. And again, thanks for listening.